This is Audible.
Audible Originals presents Ghost Station, written by Dan Wells, performed by Jonathan Davis, with an author's note read by the author, Dan Wells.
Thursday, October 19th, 1961, 7 a.m., West Berlin. 2 months after the wall. The train seemed to hold its breath. The crowd hadn't been particularly boisterous to begin with. It was the morning commute, and most of the passengers had still been half asleep as they stood in the underground station, clutching the newspapers they hadn't dared to read. They filed into the D train in a somnolent haze, finding their seats or standing and grabbing the bars. But then the train had lurched into motion, creeping forward into the darkness, and the feel of the silence had changed abruptly. It wasn't sleepy anymore, but solemn, tense, frightened. It was time for the ghost stations. The D train started its journey in the French sector of Berlin in Gesundbrunnen, and then moved to Folterstrasse, where Wallace Reed and several others shambled aboard to join them. Now it moved into the Soviet sector, where 2 months ago the East German police had started building a wall through the heart of the city. For the first few days, Reed and the others had been able to delude themselves that it was only temporary, that the wall was just a show of force, and that the East German government, the GDR, would bring it down again after they'd gotten whatever it was that they'd wanted. Those delusions had evaporated just a few days later when the East German police had started bricking up the windows in the buildings along the border. The first of the ghost stations was Bernauer Straße, and the GDR had filled its doors with bricks as well. It was deep inside of East Berlin, but it served only a West Berlin train, so it existed now only as a passing ruin, an abandoned platform, barely visible in the darkness. Reed looked out the window as the train moved through the station, seeing nothing but vague impressions of walls and columns. The next two stations were the same, closed and empty like forgotten mausoleums. Reed wasn't the only passenger who peered out as they rumbled through, hoping to catch a glimpse of something. People, maybe? Or light? Some riders didn't look at all, but simply slumped in their seats, sleeping or pretending to, pushing the ghosts away and thinking of anything else. And then the train passed through Alexanderplatz, and they couldn't ignore the ghosts anymore because they could hear them. Alexanderplatz and Janowitzbrücke, after it, were still in use by East German trains, clattering through in the levels above. Somehow, Reed thought, that made it worse. The Western train passed through the Eastern stations like a phantom, never pausing, never interacting, just two parallel worlds that overlapped without touching. Shapes and sounds and memories here and gone in an instant. 2 months, thought Reed. 10 weeks, 49 workdays there and back, which meant 98 train rides in total. 98 chances for the GDR to say, no, we're not letting you through this time. Or worse yet, no, we're not letting you back out. The last ghost station was Heinrich Heine Straße, and that one always made Reed the most nervous of all. Would something happen? Would they make it through this time? If there was a problem on the tracks, would the West German maintenance workers even be able to reach them? The empty station passed by in the shadows, barely more than a wide space in the tunnel. And soon they were back in the light again, back in the west, pulling to a stop at the bright, bustling station of Moritzplatz. Well, thought Reed, Maybe not exactly bustling, but after the ghost stations, anything felt like a riot of color and life. He always had to stop himself from just leaving the train right there and walking the rest of the way to work, but it was only nerves. They were safe now. He breathed again, feeling as if he'd held his breath through all 6 stations and rode 3 more stops to Hermannplatz. Then he transferred to the C1 train for 1 more stop, got out at Rathaus Neukölln, and walked the last few blocks to, ironically, the wall again. It twisted through the city like a snake, swinging one way and then doubling back on itself. Reed's office was right on the edge, so close that on a sudden impulse he walked 10 steps past the building door and right up to the wall itself. Chest-high cinder blocks with 3 more feet of razor wire rising from the top. On the other side was a building that was an exact twin of his own, facing it like a reflection. 6 stories tall with rows of windows so close you could wave from one side to the other. In the small park next to it, people strolled or talked or sat on benches. Life seemed much the same as ever. Almost. Reed rested his hands on the wall, almost disconcerting in its normalcy, while an East German policeman watched him from a few meters away. The border police were called Grenztruppen, or Grenzers if you weren't feeling especially respectful, and they were everywhere. Even before the wall, Heidelberger Strasse had been a border between the American and Soviet sectors of the city. Now the border was more visible and more ominous. Half a block down from him, 2 women chatted, one on either side of the wall. Lifelong neighbors, perhaps, now locked in separate nations. If either of them tried to cross, or even to hand something to the other, the Grenzers would leap into action. They'd shot someone just a few days ago, trying to cross one of the canals. It made Reed nervous to work this close to the wall, but there would be little point in putting his office anywhere else. He was a cryptographer, and the office was a listening station designed to spy on the Soviets and the GDR. He tapped the wall a final time, then turned and went into the building. It was an apartment, like most in this area, but an entire floor had been fully converted to their office space. A joint intelligence office staffed by both the American CIA and the German BND. Someone before Reed's time had scrambled the 2 acronyms and nicknamed the place Cabin D. Reed thought it was corny, but it had stuck, so there it was. He took the elevator to the 4th floor, technically the 5th, he thought, but Europeans numbered them differently, and showed his ID to the guard. The man waved him through, and Reed stepped into the main office.
"And look who's here," said Frank Schwartz, looking up from his desk with a smile. "Nice of you to drop by."
"Cut him some slack," said Chuck DeMille. "He's only 2 minutes late. What is this, East Germany?"
"Not funny," said Harold Wagner.
He was the new guy in the office, and Reed didn't know what to make of him yet. It was hard enough for Reed to interact with people as it was, and Wagner made it even more difficult by living up to every stereotype of the humorless German pragmatist.
"He was looking at the wall,"
said another voice, and Reed looked over to see Johannes Ostertag, his cryptography counterpart for the BND, sitting in an open window and blowing cigarette smoke into the morning air. Ostertag smiled and pointed out the window.
"I saw you."
Reed sat at his desk and picked up the stack of papers the secretary had left for him.
"I should have expected that."
He was no good at small talk, or any talk, really, but he was trying to teach himself to be better. Should he say something else? There was only one reason Ostertag sat in the window, and he ventured to ask about it. "Is she there?"
"Every morning,"
said Ostertag and flashed a wolfish smile. My East German Aphrodite.
I think it's obscene, said Yannick Wohlreich. He was the asset handler on the team, which always struck Reed as an odd match for someone so prudish. All of those posies, and in a public park, it's pornographic.
It's called yoga, said Frank. It's the big new thing back in New York.
Then it should stay in New York, said Wohlreich.
I'm happy with her right where she is, said Ostertag, looking out the window. His mouth curled into a smile. Doing exactly what she's doing.
Wohlreich grumbled and Reed laughed, and then a woman's voice rang through the room, and the mood changed abruptly from lechery to embarrassment.
She is on the other side of the wall, said Lisa Kohler.
She'd just come in from a hallway. Reed wouldn't have laughed at Ostertag's joking if she'd been in the main room. She crossed to her desk and sat down.
You may as well give up.
The wall doesn't stop me from looking,
said Ostertag with a leer. Lisa raised her eyebrow.
What's the point of looking if you never get to talk to her?
Ostertag smiled again.
Why spoil a good relationship with talking?
That, said Wohlreich, is the worst comment yet.
Is this an office, asked the stoic Wagner, or a locker room?
Some of us are trying to work.
Ostertag took another drag on a cigarette, then flicked it out the window and slid the pane closed.
Not much to look at these days anyway, he said. It's too cold. She wears sweatpants.
Widerlich,
Wohlreich muttered. Ostertag grinned and sank down at the desk across from Reed's. The main room in the cabin held 8 desks, grouped into pairs. 2 analysts, DeMille and Lisa, 2 surveillance operatives, Wagner and Schwartz, 2 cryptographers, Reed and Ostertag, and a 4th pair of officers that included Wohlreich, the asset handler, and Gisela Breuer, the researcher. Both Wohlreich and Gisela were BND, but every other pair was split, 1 BND and 1 CIA. Similar listening stations dotted West Berlin, each organized slightly differently but all focused on one main goal: to know everything the other side did before they did it. The wall had caught the West by surprise. They had sworn that nothing else would. Gisela swept into the room from the back hall and started handing out a new report for the top of each officer's pile.
New information on Werner Probst? It looks like he was a criminal.
Was it an execution? Asked Ostertag.
No, said Gisela, moving to her seat. Definitely an escape attempt, but he had a criminal record.
Reed scanned the report quickly. Werner Probst had tried to flee the GDR 5 days ago by swimming the Spree River. He slipped into the water by the Schillingsbrücke, probably hoping to hide in the bridge's shadow, but the Grenzers saw him, warned him, and then fired on him when he refused to turn back. He died on the western shore, but the GDR picked him up in a boat and took him back before anyone in the West had time to respond. The BND hadn't even figured out his name until recently. Now Gisela had turned up new information. Probst was a high school dropout, 25 years old, who had been arrested for stealing. Before he died, he'd been living with his parents.
This doesn't fit the profile, said Ostertag. The ones who try to cross the wall are idealists, or at least ideologists. This man seems like he'd be happy to live in a state determined to take care of him.
Maybe he loved freedom for its own sake, said Frank. He didn't want teachers bossing him around in school, and he didn't want communists bossing him around outside of it.
His parents' home was only a few blocks from the bridge.
Lisa tapped the paper to emphasize her point.
That suggests this might have been impulsive rather than planned.
And it does fit a profile, said DeMille. Not for a runner, though. For an agent. Ostertag frowned.
One of ours.
One of theirs, said DeMille. Werner Probst is exactly the kind of man the Stasi liked to use. Checkered past, unsettled present. Someone morally flexible enough to do their work and poor enough to need it. The Stasi were East Germany's spies and secret police. Chuck pursed his lip, staring at the paper, and then nodded. $5 says he was Stasi.
Only five? Asked Ostertag.
10, said Chuck. Reed watched the exchange quietly, wishing he had something to add.
So, said Frank, why'd the Russians shoot him?
The East Germans, Vollreich corrected.
We all know it's the Russians calling the plays, said Frank.
If he was a Stasi agent, said Lisa, the Grenzers who shot him probably didn't know it, which means either he was tired of being an agent and wanted to defect, or he had been ordered to join the refugees on our side as a double agent who could report back on our activities. So either the Grenzers are heroes for stopping him, or someone is going to lose their job.
Find out which, said Vollreich.
He wasn't their boss, but he usually acted like it. Bettina Schall, the chief secretary, interrupted the conversation.
Wallace, she said from the doorway to her office, we have another Longshore message.
Reed grabbed a pad of paper and a pencil and stood up.
Maybe he knows about Probst.
Longshore was their own agent, working undercover on the other side of the wall. He'd been with the Stasi for years now and still managed to send a coded message almost every day. He was easily the most valuable asset the cabin had.
Good luck, said Ostertag, and followed it up with a wink at Bettina.
Reed frowned. The man would wink at anything in a skirt. Reed followed Bettina through her office and into the chief's beyond. Gordon Davis sat at his desk, skimming through a copy of Gisela's report.
Chief, said Reed, and Davis looked up. We have a Longshore message.
It just came in, said Bettina. It's on the recorder.
Good, said Davis and gestured at Gisela's report. Maybe he can shed some light on this.
That's what we were hoping as well, sir,
said Reed. Do you have today's confirmation code?
Every coded message included a confirmation somewhere in it, a secret code within a code that let the receivers know that the sender hadn't been compromised. In a case like Longshore, where the messages came in simply as Morse code blips on a radio broadcast, the confirmation appeared as the first and final letters of every message. It was their only way of knowing that the message came from the right person.
Today's confirmation code is V, said Davis. Bring it to me as soon as you're done.
Of course, sir.
Reed nodded to the chief, then to Bettina, then walked into a side room where the radio equipment sat heavily on a desk. Longshore's messages usually came in the early mornings, but they could arrive at any time of day or night, so a triggered recorder had been set up to automatically tape anything that appeared on the frequency. Reed pulled the reel of tape from the recorder, threaded in a new one, and then took the tape into yet another room, completely bare except for a table, a chair, a tape player, and a steel safe, welded firmly to both the floor and the wall. He locked the door behind him, much sturdier than the rest of the building's doors, and carefully latched all of the extra bolts. This was the most secure room in the cabin, and for good reason. If an enemy agent got their hands on the contents of the safe, they could figure out not just Longshore's codes, but maybe even his identity. Reed set his pad and pencil on the table and the tape reel beside it. Last of all, he pulled his sidearm from the holster under his jacket and checked the chamber to make sure it was loaded and ready to fire. It was a high-standard 22LR with an integrated suppressor, which was standard issue for a CIA operative. If someone tried to breach the room, he was ready to defend it. Reed knelt, twisted the combination lock on the safe, and dialed it carefully through the sequence of numbers. It opened with a click, and he pulled out the code key. It was a hardback book, maybe an inch thick, the dust jacket missing and the blue fabric stained from water damage. Player Piano by Kurt Vonnegut Jr. Reed threaded the tape through the player, hit play, and listened to the scratchy, empty static. After several seconds, the first part of the message appeared, a burst of noise so fast he could barely interpret it as Morse code, lasting about 8 seconds. He kept listening, and almost 60 seconds later, another burst came through. 4 more followed, each about 8 seconds long, each about a minute apart. He waited for 5 more minutes, listening to the staticky silence, before confirming that this was the whole message. 6 bursts. He rewound the tape, slowed it to a crawl, and started transcribing the Morse code as it played through again, where before each burst had taken 8 seconds, it was now nearly 40. The dots and dashes were more discernible, and he wrote them down quickly, rewinding and listening several times to be sure he'd gotten it right. Then he started decoding the message. The first letter was not a V. This was the 41st message Longshore had sent using the player piano code system. Reed had personally decoded every one of them. He knew what he was doing, and the first letter was supposed to be the confirmation code, V. And yet, it was an X. Longshore hadn't used the proper confirmation. Reed let out a long breath. This could mean any number of things. Perhaps the Stasi had cracked their encryption system, always a danger since they'd started using player piano, and this was Longshore's way of telling the cabin that someone was listening and all of the information in the message was actually fake. Or perhaps it was the much worse and far more likely scenario that Longshore had been captured or compromised and the Stasi were forcing him to send misinformation. Either way, nothing in the rest of the message could be trusted. But the chief would still want to know what it said. Reed decoded the second letter and found another X. There was barely a handful of English words that started with X, and none of them seemed likely to show up in a coded message from a Stasi double agent. Was he using an abbreviation? Reed tried the third letter and got a C, then an E, then an O, P, J, N, and A. This wasn't an abbreviation or an acronym or any other explanation Reed could think of. It was gibberish. A botched confirmation code would be bad news, but this appeared to be an entire botched message. Reed checked his work again and then went back to the tapes and started over from the beginning, slowing the reel even more to make sure he'd transcribed it correctly. He had. His methods were sound and his figures added up. And yet every bit of it was meaningless nonsense. At least with the bad confirmation code, they would know what to do. They had procedures and contingency plans. When the entire message was bad, this was so much worse. 11:30 a.m., West Berlin. Wallace Reed and Section Chief Gordon Davis walked briskly through the city, sidearms loaded and ready under their jackets. An armored briefcase was handcuffed to Reed's wrist and tightly locked. They were headed west, toward a U.S. military office near the Tempelhof Airport. The mysterious Longshore message was no longer an issue for just one listening station. The government wanted a full report. "Stop looking over your shoulder," said Davis. "You look like a spy." "I'm sorry," said Reed, and shook his head to clear it. He forced himself to calm down. "I'm just worried that
Somebody's following us.
Of course somebody's following us, said Davis. It's Fulreich. He's about a block behind, watching our backs.
Reed swallowed.
Who's watching his?
He was the BND's best field agent before he came to us.
Davis was silent a moment before continuing. And the best in the Wehrmacht before that. He's fine.
Reed kept his eyes forward, matching pace with Davis.
Are you comfortable with that, Chief? Working with Nazis, I mean?
Former Nazis. Does that make it better?
It's inarguably better, said Davis.
Whether that moves it all the way to good is up for debate.
I don't like it, said Reed.
The BND are our best allies against the GDR and the Soviet Union, said Davis. And the BND gets much of its strength from former Nazis. It's run by one, for goodness sake.
I'm not any happier about that than you are, but the communists are a bigger threat right now, and intelligence work requires a flexible morality. You know that.
I know, said Reed.
And you're in the thick of it now, said Davis.
The U.S. and the USSR are global superpowers, and that gives them something far more dangerous than nuclear weapons.
Surveillance? Asked Reed.
Momentum, said Davis. They're like wind-up toys, and we've wound them tight, and they're never going to stop until they've reached the end.
What's at the end?
The dissolution of the Soviet Union and the triumph of American democracy.
Davis cast Reed a sidelong glance.
Didn't you read the brochure?
Reed tried to laugh at the joke, but jingoism hadn't been nearly as funny since the wall had gone up. Too many people took it seriously now. Even so, he tried gamely to play along.
Of course I've read it, he said and smiled.
Twice.
Never admit that out loud, said Davis. True patriots believe it the first time through.
They walked on, and when they reached the Tempelhof building, they showed their identification at the door, and a U.S. Army soldier escorted them to an elevator. They stood in an upstairs waiting room for barely a moment before an older man with a gray military haircut ushered them into his office.
Thank you for coming, he said, and locked the door behind them. I'm Mike Hogan, U.S. State Department.
Gordon Davis, Section Chief in Listening Station 7. He shook Hogan's hand. This is my lead cryptographer, Wallace Reed.
Hogan held out his hand and Reed tried to shake it, only to realize that his right hand still held the handle of the briefcase.
Sorry, he mumbled. He transferred the briefcase to his left hand and stuck out his right as far as the chain would let him.
Sorry, he said again.
Wallace Reed, sir, it's a pleasure to meet you.
Hogan shook his hand, saying nothing about the awkward fumble, and moved around toward the large black chair behind his desk. Have a seat. I understand you've lost a field agent.
Nothing certain yet, said Davis, though it doesn't look good.
He pulled a small key from a hidden compartment in his waistband and unlocked the chain on Reed's wrist, then used a separate key to unlock the case. All three men sat down and Davis continued.
A BND operative codenamed Longshore has been working as a double agent inside of the Stasi for almost 3 years now. He runs one of our number stations, and when the wall went up, he stayed in his position to continue sending us intel. He sent us 41 messages in total, but today's message 41 is suspect, to say the least.
I'm not a spy, said Hogan, so you'll have to forgive my ignorance. What's a number station?
Sorry, said Davis. A number station is simply a person with a radio who broadcasts coded messages as strings of numbers. It's a good way of sending messages, especially in a city like this, because the enemy can't trace who is listening and has no idea what the agent is saying. We have 5 or 6 number stations working for us, both on our side of the wall and on the other. The Stasi have several of their own, and the CIA is constantly trying to root them out.
Our job at the listening station is to receive and interpret some of our messages and to eavesdrop on their messages and figure out what they mean.
During the war, my unit worked behind German lines, said Hogan. Not spycraft like you, but special ops, that sort of thing. The Nazis could never find our radio when we were receiving a signal. You can't trace a signal to a receiver, but they came after us every time we tried to transmit. How has Longshore managed to survive 3 years over there without getting caught?
Davis looked at Reed. Wally?
Yes, said Reed, and pulled the briefcase up onto his knees. He clicked it open, raised the lid, and pulled out a small metal box with four black dials.
He tried to speak clearly, without umming or mumbling.
This is an FS-7 transmitter, which is standard issue for covert operations. It fits in the palm of your hand, as you can see, so it's portable and easy to conceal, but it can generate a signal strong enough to send a message anywhere in the city and well out in the countryside if needed.
The danger's not the size of the radio, said Hogan. It's the length of the transmission. The Nazi army used detection rigs in the backs of trucks. They just drive them around the countryside looking for signals, and the longer we stayed on the air, the more time they had to narrow in on us. I assume the Stasi have the same thing.
Technology's advanced, said Davis. Today they have portable detection rigs that can be hidden under a trench coat. We have the same thing. They pick up a signal and then buzz a little when you get closer to the source.
But Longshore never transmitted long enough to trace her, said Reed.
He set the transmitter on the desk and pulled from the briefcase another box, thicker than the first, but with a smaller footprint.
This is an RT3 burst encoder. Inside it are two cylinders. Well, let me show you.
He pulled off the lid, revealing the machinery inside, and Hogan leaned over his desk to see.
It looks like my daughter's music box, said Hogan.
A programmable music box, yes, said Reed, and pointed at a row of metal tabs. You set these switches to the letters you want to broadcast and then turn the crank. A small handle rested inside the open box. Reed took it out, plugged it into a hole in the side, and started turning this crank. As one cylinder moves across the other, it translates your message into Morse code and sends it through the FS-7. It takes 13 turns of the crank to broadcast a full cylinder. That's 25 characters. A trained operator can do that in about 8 seconds, though if you're really pressed for time, you can put the crank in this other hole instead and do it in 3. He moved the handle to a second hole and demonstrated the faster speed. It's not as easy to interpret on our end because even when we slow down the recording, the Morse dots and dashes start to blend together. Sometimes it's worth it, though, if you're really worried about being found. The recording this morning was done at normal speed, so we got a very clear transcription.
Reed started moving the switches, clicking through them one at a time to show how easy it was to set them.
A practiced operator with the message already encoded on a separate piece of paper can set a full 25 characters in about a minute, turn the crank to send it, and then set another 25 characters and so on. The message this morning took 6 cycles to complete, which is almost 7 minutes in total, but only 48 seconds of that was active transmission time, and that was broken down into 8-second bursts. It's virtually impossible for a directional signal finder to track a transmitter in such a short amount of time. So yes, we're fairly certain the Stasi know about Longshore's transmissions, but there's virtually no way they can ever find him.
Virtually, said Hogan. He stared at the burst encoder for a moment, then put a finger on one of the cylinder switches and clicked it back and forth. Are you sure you didn't miss a letter? He asked, looking up. Even one dropped dot in the Morse could throw off the entire sequence.
Reed smiled nervously.
I promise that's not the issue with this message, sir. I've gone over it nearly 20 times. I'm not doubting you, said Hogan.
I'm just making sure. If you weren't good at your job, you wouldn't be here. He looked at Reed for a moment, then back at Davis. Let's talk about the encryption itself. How are the messages coded?
We used to use a one-time pad, said Davis. That's a sheet of random numbers that helps scramble the message. He had one copy, we had the other.
Scramble, asked Hogan. How?
By adding them together, said Reed. The first step is a simple Caesar cipher. A equals 1, B equals 2, and so on. So if I were going to say hello, it would be...
A equals 1, asked Hogan. Surely the CIA could come up with something a little more sophisticated than that.
This is only the first step, said Reed. It doesn't matter what A equals because of the way they get scrambled in the second step, so we use something easy. But back to the example, if I were to say hello, like I was saying, we would start with the numbers 8, 5, 12, 12, 15.
Hogan raised his eyebrow. You know that off the top of your head?
He thinks in codes, said Davis. Reed felt himself blush a little, but pressed forward. It was easier to talk about encryption than about himself.
So I take those numbers. The first is 8. Then I look at my one-time pad, and let's say the first number there is a 2. I add them together, get 10, and that's what I transmit. And anyone with an identical pad will see the 10, subtract the 2, and say, oh, he means 8. So this letter is an H. And anybody who doesn't have that exact pad will be completely lost. It's impossible to break.
Virtually, said Hogan.
No, said Davis. Literally. With a properly randomized number sequence, a one-time pad is 100% secure. The number 10 in Mr. Reed's example could represent any letter in the alphabet. It's like a mathematical singularity. All of the things cryptographers use to break codes, all the patterns in the data, completely disappear.
Impressive, said Hogan, though he spotted the downside barely a second later. So your only weak points are physical. Getting and keeping a copy of the pad without the Stasi finding it.
That's exactly right, said Davis. It's called a one-time pad because you can only use it once, use it twice, and you've put patterns back into the data, and that makes it crackable. Before the war, we used a dead drop to deliver a week's worth of number pads in one go. Longshore could pick it up hours later, so none of us ever had personal contact with him. His position inside the Stasi is too precarious to risk. But then the wall went up, and we couldn't reach our dead drop locations anymore. And there's no way to establish any new ones. The only thing both he and we can reach is the wall itself. And it's watched far too closely.
Official government personnel can move through the city at will, said Hogan. Even beyond the wall. One of us could drop it for you.
We have an entire branch of the joint CIA and BND dedicated to watching every move the GDR's officers take when they come on our side, said Davis. I assure you, you're all being watched at least that closely when you travel over there.
Hogan scowled. I suppose that's true.
Reed reached into the briefcase and grabbed something but didn't pull it out.
We're about to show you something incredibly secret.
Hogan's look darkened, but Davis jumped in quickly to assuage any insult.
This is secret even within our own office, even among people who are technically cleared for it. Reed isn't here because he's higher ranking than the others. He's here because he and I are the only people in the world who hold this secret. Us and Longshore, of course. Even a casual reference to the nature of the secret, overheard by the wrong ears, could get our man killed.
Understood, said Hogan. Proceed. Reed swallowed. Longshore's last message on the old pads established a new system, a new pad that he and we both had access to, with enough numbers to keep him going for as long as possible. Reed pulled his hands from the briefcase and set the copy of Player Piano on the desk. A novel? Asked Hogan. Longshore had a copy with him when the wall went up, said Reed. His final message on his last pad was to lay out this new system. He started at the beginning of chapter one and translated each letter of the book into the same A1 cipher we use on the messages. Each subsequent message picks up right where the previous one left off. We bought the same edition of the same book and used that to decode what he's written. So in practice, it's just like having a one-time pad.
Except the numbers the book generates aren't random, said Hogan, catching on immediately. Your mathematical singularity breaks down.
It's not as secure as a truly random pad, said Reed, nodding. If the Stasi figure out that he's using a book, they can start to look for patterns they wouldn't have otherwise noticed.
Not to mention, said Davis, that if they can figure out which book, they can just read the messages straight out. We understand the risks, but it's the best we could do under the circumstances.
The wall caught us all by surprise, Reed added.
If you'd done your jobs right, it wouldn't have, said Hogan.
Reed reeled at the verbal attack. Hogan seemed to be done playing nice.
If you had a man inside of the Stasi and you still didn't know about the wall going up, maybe he's not really your man.
We have considered that possibility, said Davis.
And?
And Longshore's information is too consistently accurate to be a disinformation campaign by a suborned agent. He's helped us too much. Plus, I'll remind you that he's only one of several dozen double agents the CIA has placed in the GDR. He's the only one we work with directly, and goodness knows how the other listening stations are staying in touch with their operatives, but the point stands. None of them warned us about the wall. Either every single one of our undercover agents has turned on us, or the GDR is very, very good at keeping secrets.
Hogan thought about this for a moment, then shook his head. I still don't like it. You're using a questionable agent with a crackable code system. You're lucky he's lasted as long as he did. At this point, we have to consider him broken.
I think you're wrong, sir, said Reed.
Hogan looked at him, and Reed felt a sudden stab of nerves.
He swallowed and started again. There are two main scenarios for a compromised agent. First, that the enemy knows he's a mole and feeds him false information to confuse us. We've always been able to verify Longshore's reports through other sources, so we're fairly certain that this hasn't happened with him.
But you won't be certain until the current message is also verified, said Hogan.
How can you verify gibberish? Asked Davis. The scenario Reed is talking about is always a concern, but it doesn't explain this particular message.
Fair enough, said Hogan. What's the second scenario?
But he knows they're feeding him false intel, said Reed, but he remains loyal to us. In this scenario, the compromised agent has two options. First, ignore the false stuff and keep sending us good stuff at the risk of being caught and killed. The Stasi have no use for a spy they can't manipulate after all, so if they can't use him to confuse us, they'll simply remove him altogether.
Death isn't a very good option, said Hogan.
Certainly not, said Davis. But it might still be useful if there's something of dire importance to tell us, something worth giving his life for.
The rise of the wall, for example, said Hogan.
If he'd known about it, yes, said Davis.
Reed could tell he was getting angry at the constant insinuations of distrust.
"A compromised agent's second option is very clever," said Reed. "He can pass us whatever false information the enemy wants him to pass us, but he can mark it as false with a confirmation code so we know not to trust it."
"For Longshore, that's a single letter," said Davis. "Assigned daily. If the message is real, he puts that day's letter at the front of each message and pads it out with more of the same letter at the end. If the information in the message is false, he uses a different letter, and we know that the information is not to be trusted."
"Wait," said Hogan, leaning forward.
"You said earlier that you couldn't contact him. Now you say you're sending him a daily code?"
"The delivery system for the confirmation codes is a secret not even Mr. Reed knows," said Davis. "Suffice it to say that it's only one letter, and it only goes one way. Trying to send him any substantive message would be impossible."
Reed's mind began to race. What did Davis do that could only send one letter?
He'd wondered about the delivery system before, of course, but the fact that it was only the one letter was a new constraint, and a constraint was like gold to a cryptographer. Now wasn't the time to think about it, though. He filed the information away in his head and focused on the conversation.
"The point I'm trying to make," said Reed, "is that neither of those two scenarios for a compromised agent applies in this case. He's not sending us deathbed intel or clearly marked lies. He's not even sending us full-fledged lies, which is what he would do if he'd been turned completely to the other side. Whatever is going on here, I really don't think he's been compromised."
"What about the third scenario?" asked Hogan. "Let's say Longshore was captured and interrogated, but he gave them a bad code. They tried to use it to send us something, and all we got was gibberish."
"That's the first theory yet that can actually explain the gibberish," said Reed.
"And it is my working theory," said Davis. "The Stasi are engaged in a disinformation campaign designed to use our own double agent to feed us lies. Now that we know it exists, our best course of action is to pretend like the messages are real and let them waste their time and energy sending nonsense to an automated tape recorder."
Hogan stared at Davis for a moment, then flashed a smile so harsh and predatory, Reed couldn't help but lean away from it.
"As I said to your companion, Mr. Davis, if you were bad at your job, you wouldn't be here."
Reed looked back and forth between the two men, wondering what he'd missed.
"What do you mean?" "Mr. Reed," said Hogan, keeping his eyes on Davis. "What's the name of your boss's counterpart in the Stasi? The section chief in charge of whatever station Longshore is a part of?"
"His name is Conrad Zedel," said Reed, confused.
"We have files on all of them."
"You have files," said Hogan. "What is the name of their lead cryptographer?"
"Jürgen Bauer."
"Their asset handler?"
"Hans Novak."
"Their researcher?"
Martin something? They have two. I think the lead is Martin Fogel."
Reed frowned.
"Sir, why are you asking me this?"
"As we've said several times in this meeting," said Hogan, "everything we do, they do. The U.S. and the Soviets are like reflections of each other, and this divided city is the mirror. If you know who the Stasi agents are, the Stasi agents definitely know who you are. So when this message arrived barely more than an hour ago and your office dropped everything for an immediate meeting with the State Department, I can guarantee you that they noticed. If your section chief was really trying to convince the Stasi that nothing was wrong and that this message was perfectly normal, he's failed spectacularly." Reed stared at him in shock.
Davis paused a moment longer, then stated, "I'm impressed, Mr. Hogan. You said you weren't a spy.
I'm worse,"
said Hogan. I'm a politician.
Wait, said Reed. Are you accusing Davis of lying? You can't be serious.
I'm accusing him, said Hogan, of not sharing everything he's thinking.
Then what, asked Davis crisply, am I thinking?
I couldn't say.
Hogan turned his full attention from Davis to Reed.
What about you?
Reed blinked.
Do I know what Davis is thinking? Do you know what Wallace Reed is thinking? Hogan asked.
I can tell when someone's lying to me, but that doesn't mean I can conjure up the truth. You, though, that's your job.
You're a code breaker, and this is a code. So, what's your theory?
Reed glanced at Davis, who said nothing. Reed swallowed. He had a theory, and had in fact been working it through in his head for some time now, but it wasn't a good one, and he certainly didn't want to share it here.
But what else could he do?
Sir, I think it's best if we take this situation at face value.
This was a coded message sent by an agent containing important information.
Exactly what it looks like.
Maybe our only mistake, sir, is in thinking that the message was sent to us.
Hogan's eyebrow went up.
Who else would it have been sent to?
Reed grimaced, hating to say it out loud.
Well, sir, it's like you said, we're reflections of each other. And we have a double agent in the Stasi. So I think we have to consider that they might have a double agent in the cabin.
3:32 p.m., West Berlin.
That was foolish, said Davis, walking back to the cabin.
He asked for my opinion,
Reed protested, but Davis cut him off, and you told him our entire office was untrustworthy.
Obviously, a double agent is the most likely explanation, and obviously, we're going to try to find him, but that doesn't mean you go and tell the entire State Department we've been infiltrated.
So you suspected the same thing?
Don't insult me, Davis snapped. Of course I suspected. It's my job to suspect, and I assumed that you thought the same way.
I just thought you were smart enough not to say it out loud.
I'm sorry, said Reed.
You're not just a hobbyist anymore, said Davis, solving newspaper puzzles in your bathrobe. You're a spy for the CIA. Start acting like it.
Why do you think I fed him that story about a captured agent? Because we need to handle this on our own without the State Department breathing down our necks.
Understood, said Reed.
The one question continued to bother him. Why had Davis gone to the State Department at all? They walked in silence the rest of the way back, and when they reached the office, Reed sat at his desk with a somber frown.
Frank watched Davis's back as he went into Bettina's office, then beyond it into his own. As soon as he closed the door, Frank looked at Reed.
Rough meeting.
Yeah, said Reed and blew out a low breath. I think I may have caused a big problem for all of us.
This doesn't sound good, said Ostertag, leaning in toward the conversation. What happened?
Reed stopped.
He wasn't going to make the same mistake twice. If Davis suspected that the cabin had a mole, then he certainly wasn't going to blab it all over the office. You had to be careful in a situation like this because you never knew who was listening.
Wait.
Reed stared at his desk, thinking, who was listening? Which person inside of the cabin was this message intended for? Because the way it was sent didn't make a lot of sense. If the Stasi had the means to give their hidden agent an entire decoding system, sophisticated enough to decrypt a 150-character message, couldn't they deliver the actual message through the same means? Why did they need to use the longshore frequency at all? It had tipped their hand, revealed their presence, and a portion of their plans, and there was no good reason to do that if you had any other way of passing your message, which meant there wasn't any other way. This was the best and only way that this particular message could be sent. That implied, in Reed's mind, three possibilities. Number one, there was no double agent, but the Stasi were trying to make it look like there was. They were trying to sow discord in the cabin, make them all suspicious of each other, or make the State Department suspicious of them all. If that was their plan, it was working. Number two, it was a deathbed message. Like they'd posited in the meeting, something had gone so wrong and the need to communicate had become so dire that it was worth burning an entire communication channel and a valuable agent just to get the message across. If there really was a double agent, contacting him so publicly could only possibly end in that agent being discovered, tracked down, and either caught or scared away, which would make this the beginning of the end. But, possibility number three. Maybe there was a double agent in the cabin, but message 41 wasn't for him. It was about him. Maybe the message had come from Longshore, not a traitorous Longshore, but a faithful one, trying to warn them about a Stasi mole without letting that mole know they were onto him. Because you never knew who was listening.
Reed mulled over this last one. If he were in the field with brand new intel about a double agent inside of the cabin, how would he go about it? The first thing he'd do was find a way to send a message that only some of the cabin officers could read. The garbled message 41 might fit that bill, provided that someone, at some point, could read it at all. But who and how? Davis was the only one who even knew who Longshore was, so this might have been a secret message just to him, using a code they'd established before going undercover. Except Davis hadn't privately decrypted it. He'd taken it straight to the State Department. So whoever was supposed to receive and decrypt the message almost certainly wasn't Davis. Was it possible that the message was intended for someone in the State Department? If it was, this had to be the most convoluted way of getting it there. Why send it here first unless you were certain it would get relayed directly to Hogan's office? And how could you be certain of that unless Davis was somehow in on it? And then why involve Reed? And why carry out that whole business of Hogan and Davis distrusting each other? No. It was too big of a mess with too many variables. Spycraft, for all its twists and secrets, would always default toward Occam's razor. The simplest explanation was the best. The message had been sent to the cabin because Longshore wanted someone in the cabin to read it, and he didn't want anyone else to be able to. Reed had a moment of panic when he followed that particular line of thought. Why change the encryption system unless you were specifically trying to hide the code from him, Reed, the man who received them, decrypted them, and read them? And why hide the code from Reed unless he was the double agent you were trying to expose?
Reed knew, of course, he wasn't a double agent or a traitor or a Stasi mole. He had no secret handlers or foreign contacts or really any contacts at all outside of the cabin. These were his only friends and essentially his only acquaintances. He knew he was safe. But did Longshore know that? I need to focus on the immediate concerns, he thought. The message was sent to someone here in the cabin, and now he just needed to figure out how that person was supposed to read it. Occam's razor came into play here as well. Longshore had not likely had time or opportunity to establish a new code system with anyone in the cabin, which meant that he was still using the same code system that was already in place. He was using player piano. But how? There had to be something Reed had missed. Reed's eyes went wide. What if they'd missed an entire message?
Hey, Wally, said Frank, and rapped his knuckles on the desk. Hey, buddy, you okay?
What?
Reed shook his head and focused on the room. Frank, Ostertag, and Lisa were staring at him.
What's happening?
You tell us, said Frank. We've been trying to get your attention for 5 minutes.
Sorry, Reed said as he stood up. I need to go back in the room.
He walked toward Bettina's office and Ostertag called after him.
Mr. Reed, are you feeling well?
Reed shut himself in the decoding room, locked the door, and checked his weapon. He opened the safe, pulled out his notes and the hardback novel, and started to work. A one-time pad encryption system was very fragile. Using the wrong pad, and it all fell apart. Decode message 41 with the wrong section of player piano, even one letter off, and all you got was garbage. But what if message 41 was actually message 42? What if there was an entire previous message that they had missed, something that hadn't been recorded or maybe hadn't even been sent? Reed opened the book. Even after 40 previous messages, they were only on the second page, starting about halfway down. Gnawed through the insulation on a control wire and put building 17, 19, and 21 temporarily out of commission. The nature of the RT3 meant that each message came in 25 character segments. If there really was a missing message 41, message 42 would start on one of those 25 character points. Reed counted across the line and made a mark between the O and the N in insulation. He counted another 25 and made a mark between the L and the D in building. He continued like this through the next several lines and then got to work testing each one. The first segment of the message was a 5. The N at the end of insulation was a 14. 5 minus 14 was -9, wrapping around the alphabet like a circle, that became a 17, which was the letter Q. Reed shook his head. He needed it to be a V to match the confirmation code. He jumped 25 characters ahead to his next mark, the D in building, and tried again. D was a 4, 5 minus 4 gave him 1, or A. Still no V. Still no good.
I'm doing this backward, Reed muttered. If I know I'm starting with a 5, which is E, and ending with a V, what letter is going to get me there?
Going backward from E to V was 9 steps, and the 9th letter was I. Reed counted almost the entire page, looking for I's at every 25th letter, and finally found one near the bottom in the word during. If that was the beginning of message 42, then the missing message 41 would be several times longer than any other message Longshore had ever sent. That seemed unlikely, but maybe that's why Longshore had sent it through a different method. Maybe the missing message was so long that sending it over the radio
would have required too much broadcasting time and given away his position? Reed started in the new section of the book and decoded the first few letters of the message, VXWHLOG. Not a word, not an abbreviation, not an acronym or anything else he could use, just more gibberish.
He counted off several more 25-character sections, looking for more eyes in the right position, but none of them gave him anything resembling a coherent message. Maybe he was thinking in the wrong direction. Maybe the missing message, if it existed, wasn't larger than usual, but much smaller. Maybe it was smaller than even the standard 25 characters. Reed shook his head, convinced that this was impossible, but he had no better ideas and knew he had to at least consider it. The first 25 characters of this section of the book included two eyes, gnawed through the insulation. He began decoding the message, starting with the first I in insulation, and got VXOFHSJ. Maybe XO referred to an executive officer, or maybe the X was of something, X of HSJ, maybe the HS was high school. They didn't even have high schools in Germany, though he supposed Longshore could have been referencing an American. He decrypted the next few letters just to be sure. MDTWIY. Nothing again. He scrapped that plan, pulled out a new sheet of paper, and tried again, starting at the second I in that same section, the one in the middle of insulation. He got VWPM, which was still nothing.
Just keep going, he muttered. You'll find it sooner or later. VWPMFS. Whoa.
Reed stopped abruptly, staring in shock at the letters he'd written on the page. MFS jumped out at him immediately because it was an acronym Longshore used all the time. Ministerium für Staatssicherheit. The Ministry for State Security. The Stasi. Reed swallowed. If MFS referred to the Stasi, what could the WP mean? An abbreviation? Initials? Who had the initials WP? Reed whispered it softly, almost not daring to believe that it was true. Werner Probst.
He dove back into the translation, forcing himself not to rush, to take his time and do it right, and worked out the next few letters. A-G-E-N-T. Reed shouted in triumph and smacked the table with his hand. W-P-M-F-S, agent. Werner Probst, Stasi agent. A direct confirmation of what they'd been talking about just that morning.
Reed kept going, finished the entire message, and then grabbed the paper and ran for the door. He was halfway done unlocking it before he remembered the protocols. He went back to the table, gathered his materials, and locked them all carefully in the safe before retrieving his gun and walking back to the door again. He finished unlocking it, jogged past Bettina without a word, and barged into Davis's office, the paper clutched tightly in his fist.
I've got it!
Davis looked up.
Got what?
Reed closed the door behind himself, catching a brief glimpse of Bettina's surprised face, and then locked the door tightly. He turned back to Davis and slapped the paper down on the desk.
Message 41, he said.
Or
message 42, maybe. I think we missed one.
That's why it didn't make sense before. I was decoding it from the wrong part of the book. Keep your voice down,
Davis hissed, and then picked up the paper to read it. Reed already had it memorized. V. W. P. M. F. S. Agent C. N. Harry Siegel. M. F. S. New Op C. N. Talon is trying to turn cabin officer, no ID yet, V. V. V.
Hot damn.
Davis whispered, though his eyes were dark with worry.
Do you realize what this means? It means we missed a message somehow,
said Reed again.
A message 23 characters long? That's why I couldn't find it at first, because they're supposed to be in increments of 25, but 23 is too long for him to have just started in the wrong place, so he must have done it on purpose.
I don't mean that, said Davis. I mean the message itself. You translated the damn thing. Did you read it?
Reed trailed off. Yes. It confirms that Werner Probst was a Stasi agent, just like we thought he was, and it even gives us his identifier. CN is Longshore's standard abbreviation for codename, so Probst's codename was Harry Siegel. Then it mentions a new Stasi operation, codenamed Talon, designed to turn a cabin. Reed's face fell. Oh, wow.
Yes. Oh, wow, said Davis, though I think that's putting it lightly. The Stasi are trying to recruit one of our own officers right here in the cabin.
Doesn't that mean they already have one?
Davis raised an eyebrow. This morning you thought this garbled message had been sent to a mole in our off